How do you like to be introduced? Paul Delaney, is that good?
Yeah.
Okay.
Although I wrote under JGP Delaney because because there's a Paul Delaney in who's my doppelganger.
He's
a Brit
who
lives in British Columbia and writes on the same period but on literature. So he's written a book about Rupert Brooke. He was out before me, so when I was going to publish, I couldn't be Paul Delaney because there was another one who already was in the field, and I've sometimes been mixed up with him. So that meant that I couldn't write under Paul Delaney. So I had my three names, Joseph, Gerard, Paul. So I wrote under J.G.P. Delaney.
Okay.
But when I write on Acadian subjects, I write under Paul Delaney.
So we are at your home, Paul, in Moncton, New Brunswick. And the reason that we're together is because of your book, your biography of Charles Ricketts. So first of all, welcome to the Bibliophile.
Thank you. I feel honored.
Well, it's so great to be able to talk about Charles Ricketts, who was a wonderful book designer, a fine press proprietor, an art aficionado, a writer. Maybe you could fill
a painter,
yes.
A sculptor, a theater designer, a man of many, many abilities, and a man who was a total artist. He was an artist, pure and simple.
His whole philosophy, his approach, his attitude.
His whole life was devoted to art, to making it, to collecting it, to encouraging it, to writing about it.
Yeah.
His life was, he was an aesthete in the real good sense of the word.
What brought you to wanting to write about him?
I was actually told to write about him. When I finished my PhD in Edinburgh, I had worked on 17th century poetry. And I'd done my master's on 17th century poetry and my doctorate on 17th poetry. So I was fed up with 7th century poetry.
Right.
I wanted to do something different. And I had friends in Edinburgh who were related to Oscar Wilde's friend Robbie Ross. And so I mentioned at a dinner party, I'm looking for a totally different subject to write to work on. I don't want to write about 17th century poetry. I'm fed up with it. So they said, well, you know, our great uncle, Robbie Ross, really, we'd love someone to write a biography of him. Would you be interested? And I said, well, yes, it sounds very interesting. And they said, well, we'll arrange for you to see the papers. And John Paul Ross was a diplomat, and he was based in Jerusalem. And so he deposited all the Ross papers with Sir Rupert Hart Davis in Yorkshire. And so John Paul wrote to Sir Rupert and said, a young man, I was young at that time, I was 27 or 28, is interested in Robbie Ross, and he would like to see the papers. Would it be possible for him to visit you and see the papers? And Sir Rupert wrote back and said, yes, of course. But there's nowhere for him to stay locally, because we live in a small village, so we're going to invite him to stay with us. Okay, so I went there, and they picked me up at the station at Richmond, and then they drove me to the mosque in Swaledale, a little village where they lived, and set me up. And then the first thing almost that Sir Rupert said to me, he said, Paul, I will help you in any way I can, but really you're wasting your time in Robbie Ross. He doesn't deserve a biography. So that was a bit discouraging as the first thing that was said to me. So anyway, every day I was there for more than a week, and every day I was working hard, going through all the letters, you know, from all kinds of people, Henry James and all kinds of important writers and painters. Mm-hmm. And one day I came across Ricketts' letters, and they were so funny and so witty and so erudite and so wicked. I mean, dirty jokes, you know, everything. So he'd go from an extremely learned, you know, discussion of the attribution or the authorship of something, of a painting, and then he would tell a dirty joke right after. And I'd roar with laughter. And at dinner that evening, I said, Sir Rupert, you know, I'm reading the letters from Charles Ricketts, and they're by far the most interesting of all the letters, from famous writers. I mean, nobody comes near him.
Yeah.
And Sir Rupert jumped up, and he said, now there's a subject for you. There's a man that needs a biography. Write about him. So I thought, oh, that's interesting. So I tried to do both Robbie and Ricketts together, but Ricketts just won the day. I mean, he was so much more interesting and so much more fun.
And it's published by Oxford, right?
Yeah, it was the Clarendon Press, yeah.
And what year was it published?
Oh dear. 1999?
I know it's hard to get.
It's sold out.
Yes. And it hasn't been reprinted.
No. They were very nice. They actually wrote to me and said, "Paul, the last copy of your book is on the shelf, and we're sending it to you." So I got the last copy, but they only.
But they didn't want to reprint it.
No, I suggested it might be a good idea to reprint.
Well, I mean, they could sell it.
It sold out in just a few years. But they only printed 800 copies.
That's why it's so expensive now.
It's because they decided it was for a limited market. It was for collectors. It was for museums and galleries, period. There was no general interest.
But that's odd. I mean, you'd think that a publisher of their stature would be interested in making more money.
But they didn't think there was a market.
After it sold out in a couple of years?
Yeah. They didn't think that. They thought that the market had, you know, they reached the market they had aimed at, and that was it. You know, there was no need to make any more. And when I suggested they do a second edition with corrections and additions and whatever, they wrote back and said, no, we've had a meeting about it, and we decided it was not feasible.
That's too bad.
So that was it.
Well, they need to sit down again and think about it.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of new material since. It would have to be completely rewritten.
Right. Okay. Well, you've still got a few years left.
Yeah, but I'm on other subjects now. Okay. I'm out of the rickets field. Sir Rupert called the rickets racket. I'm out of the rickets racket.
He was a great publisher. I love his books.
Oh, yeah.
They're so elegant.
Yeah. And he was interested in quality.
Yeah.
He wasn't one of those publishers who said, oh, this will sell. He was interested in quality that would sell if possible, but quality was the first thing for him.
I love the colorful, the fox. It's a fox, right?
Yeah.
The sort of logo that he used.
Yeah. On his breast.
Yeah.
No, the book is dedicated to him and to another friend who helped me a lot with the book.
Oh, is it? Yeah. Okay. Now, Ricketts was born in Geneva, wasn't it?
He was born in Switzerland.
So maybe we could start there.
Well, this is something that's completely changed since I wrote the book. Ricketts' mother lied on her marriage certificate. She gave a false identity. And so I didn't realize that people lied on official documents. So I believed her, even though it didn't make sense. And I say in the book, because she said on her marriage certificate, she was the daughter of Charles Comte de Soucy, Marquis de Soucy. But there was no Marquis de Soucy. And there was a Comte de Soucy, and he had a whole bunch of daughters, but I found, I went to the military archives in Paris at the Chateau, whatever it's called, the Chateau de Vincennes, and I got his records, and there was one of those cards that are printed in France when somebody dies that lists all the children and the grandchildren, and there was no Hélène Cornélie de Soucy.
Okay.
So I thought, this was the only family that it could have been, okay, and she's not mentioned there. One of the ancestors had been a marquis, so it's possible that there was a marquis there and somewhere, but it didn't make sense.
Okay.
So my conclusion was that she was illegitimate, and therefore that's why she's not mentioned in the list of the daughters.
That's such a terrible word, isn't it? Illegitimate.
Yeah, it is. But at that time, it was a very damning word.
Yes.
And she was from one of the papal nobility in Rome, and she had been married young to a French architect. And the marriage had not been particularly happy. She had three or four children. And then suddenly she disappeared. She had been left some money by a family friend who was a comte or something or other, but the lady would never tell me who the comte was or how much money it was. But anyway, she was left a monthly income by him. And that enabled her to escape. So she just disappeared. After the birth of her last child, I mean, just a couple of months after the birth of her last child, she disappears. And she turns up in Naples, where Ricketts' father met her.
And Ricketts' father was?
He was a naval officer.
British?
Yeah. Ricketts were sort of gentle, sort of landed gentry. They had made a lot of money in the slave trade in the West Indies. Ricketts was from a son of that family. His father was from that family. So her marriage to Ricketts' father was bigamous, because she was already married.
Was he born in Switzerland or not?
Yeah, he was, yeah.
Okay.
But they were not married at that time. He was illegitimate, to use that same word again. Ricketts was born in 63.
Yeah. And then they moved to England shortly after, a couple of years after that.
I mean, Ricketts always said his mother was French, but she wasn't French. She was Italian. But she had this was told to me by this descendant who wouldn't give me any sources, but she was able to give me information, but she wouldn't tell me where it came from.
Okay.
She had some sort of liaison with a good-looking German waiter in the Hotel d'Allemagne in Rome, and it was considered utterly unsuitable of the papal nobility to marry this waiter in the restaurant. Her brothers wrote letters saying this is a disaster for the family, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, she was determined to marry him. But finally, they twisted her arm or whatever, and they sent her off to Paris. And then she was about 18 or something like that at that point. And so she spent the next years in Paris. And there she was married off to this Henri Suisse, his name was, who was an architect, distinguished architect. I mean, he had the Legion d'Honneur, and he's on the web. On Wiki.
Well, let's move around then to Charles in England as a child. Then he was
more French than English because, you know, his mother was French and
his mother wasn't French, though.
Yeah, but she was French culture, and so everybody said he was more European than English.
Did he go to school in Europe?
Well, he did a little bit. She always had that income from the Comte who left her money, okay. And that was one of the proofs that her descendant sent me. The last payment was not claimed, and she had just died. So it confirmed that she was the one who was receiving.
So he had sort of a traditional education then in England and maybe a bit on the continent? Is that it?
No, I think he was partly privately educated. He went to a school in France for a time. She got sick, Mrs. Ricketts got sick, and so they went to live in France, and he had a governess when he was in France, and then they went to Italy,
okay.
And then she died on their way to Rome.
When he was how old?
He was about 10 or 11.
So then he went back to England to live with his father?
Yeah, but his father went bankrupt at some point. I didn't know that at the time I wrote the book. I only discovered this later, so... I discovered it after COVID, so I can't get to England to do more research into it because of COVID. So he actually spent most of the time in England with his grandfather, whom he adored, who collected paintings and was a. He obviously got on much better with his grandfather than his father. He said, "I have nothing in common with my father but our name." He was much closer to his mother. But his grandfather was a very sweet man, obviously. Everybody loved him, and he got on very well with his grandfather.
So but it must have been obviously devastating for a 10-year-old to have his mother die on him.
Yeah, they were on their way to Rome. Obviously, she was going to reunite with her family, because she had brothers and sisters in Rome.
So she was leaving the husband?
No, they went together. Okay. She wasn't expected to die. She just died on the way. They were on their way to Rome. Okay. She had cancer.
Okay, so the grandfather... obviously molded this young boy's character.
Although I don't think it needed molding. I think he had pretty much of a character. He was very much himself. He was not molded. He was himself.
Okay.
His grandfather helped him along and left him a bit of money, but he was very close to his grandfather. He loved his grandfather, obviously.
Did he go to art school?
Yes, he did. When he was 15 or 16, he went to our school. Younger than he was supposed to, but that's where he went to an art school in South London, in the wood engraving school.
Yes.
Yeah, that's how he started. Then he moved into other subjects, but started off as a wood engraver.
And he then marketed his services as a wood...
Well, he did.
That artist?
He did. Well, in those days, they did a lot of these, I can't remember what they're called, but they're sort of lino illustrations.
Yeah. For magazines?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he did a lot of those.
Yeah.
He did woodcuts also, but he also did a lot of those.
So he set up as a freelancer?
Well, he was a young artist, on the go, trying to get jobs here and there and getting whatever he could get to work. And he'd already hooked up with Shannon at that point.
Ah, okay, so let's introduce him. That's Charles Shannon, and he was also an artist.
He was at the same school, art school, and they met supposedly at I think it was Ricketts' 15th birthday party. But there's a writer in London who's Canadian, actually, but who lives in London now, and she wrote to me recently, and she doesn't think that's true. She thinks they were older when they met, but... Sturge Moore, who was a close friend all their lives, he's the one who said they met at Ricketts' 15th birthday party.
So these two, there's an interesting relationship that they have.
perhaps difficult to figure out.
Well, that's it, because you're suggesting that that Shannon may well have been heterosexual and Ricketts homosexual, do you think? Or
it's hard to sort of classify them, but Ricketts was basically homosexual.
Yeah.
And Shannon might have gone through a homosexual phase, or maybe he was fascinated by Ricketts.
As a young man,
as
yeah.
a young man. Had, yeah. There are a lot of...
Because he had a powerful, charismatic personality.
He did, yes.
Yeah.
And he was very witty, and he was clever with words, and fun to be with, but he was very unstable underneath. He needed an anchor to hold him down, and Shannon became that anchor. And but no, Shannon was definitely heterosexual, at least mostly heterosexual. If you look at his work, his depiction of the female nudes in his lithographs and drawings is so sensual. He loved the female body. And a lot of his subjects are mothers and children, or mother and father and children. It's, to me, it represents a kind of longing for something that he could not enjoy.
Could not or would not?
Well, that's the problem. According to, I can't remember who told me this, but someone who was close to someone who was a member of the family that was close to Ricketts, I think it was Riette Sturge Moore, that Shannon had tried to get married twice, and both times Ricketts was able to persuade him not to get married. But he had relationships with his female models, Shannon did.
So the two men moved in together?
Yep. And they lived together all their lives. Later on, Shannon fell when he was hanging a picture and damaged his brain.
Yeah, it's tragic. And he was a bit of a... Was he a vegetable or...?
Yeah, he was not quite a vegetable. He could still draw very badly, and he still had, you know, some... But he became extremely hostile to Ricketts.
And Ricketts still took care of him?
Yeah.
But he's expressing this frustration that he'd had over the years.
Is yes, I think it? I think that's just by chance at a dinner party. I met a psychiatrist, and I just mentioned that question.
Yeah.
And he asked me to fill in the details, and he said, well, that's very typical. When someone's brain is damaged, they lose their inhibitions. And he was probably expressing frustrations and anger at Ricketts for having stopped him from doing things that he had wanted to do.
But he wasn't a strong enough personality to do it.
Yeah. Or he couldn't. He knew how much Ricketts depended on him, and he couldn't abandon him.
I see.
I think that that Shannon knew that Ricketts would fall to pieces if he left. Good. And also, Riette Sturge Moore had said one of the reasons that Ricketts was able to stop Shannon from getting married was saying, well, how can we divide our collection if you leave, and we have to divide our collection? But I always thought, well, if Shannon really wanted to get married, he would have said to Ricketts, you keep the collection. I don't mind. I want to get married. But it couldn't have been that strong a need. Otherwise, he would have said, no, okay, keep the collection. I don't mind.
Yeah. Okay, so when does Ricketts get into illustrating books?
That's how we started.
Yes. So when did that happen? And what are some of the books that he perhaps is best known for?
The most famous books by Oscar Wilde are The Sphinx, which yes. Ricketts designed.
And Salome, is that?
Which Aubrey Beardsley designed. But Beardsley's drawings were outrageous and provocative and sexy, and they stole all the limelight. Okay, whereas Ricketts, who designed The Sphinx, and he designed almost all of the other books by Wilde.
By that you mean he did the actual covers?
He did the covers, yeah.
But he also did the illustrations within?
He designed sometimes the title page. House of Pomegranates, Shannon did the illustrations. Ricketts did the cover, Shannon did the illustrations.
Yeah.
But most of them is just the cover that he designed, or in the title page sometimes.
And often those covers are a gold leaf too.
They're... Yeah. And then he decided he wanted to set up his own press.
Yes.
And he was introduced by Rothenstein to Llewellyn Hakin, who was a barrister who had never practiced because he had inherited money and so he never needed to work. And he was willing to invest money in Ricketts' firm. So it became the Vale Press, which was Hakin and Ricketts. And that enabled Ricketts to start designing books. He designed the fonts. He designed the woodcut illustrations. He did the page layout. But he didn't print them. They were printed at the Ballantyne Press.
Is that up in Edinburgh?
You know, they think there was a branch in London. He supervised the printing, but they were not printed by him.
In a sense, they're not a bona fide private press. He didn't do the printing himself. He yeah. oversaw the printing.
Yeah. Well, it is classified as a private press, the Vale Press.
Yes, I know. Yeah. Yeah.
But by a strict definition, maybe it wasn't.
So what does the output of that press look like? There was the Shakespeare, the full run of Shakespeare.
Yeah. They were meant to be the classics, you know, the Romantic poets, Keats, and the 17th century poets. They were not meant to be, you know, new work, except for Michael Field, the two ladies that were under the name Michael Field.
These were good friends of Shannon and Ricketts, right?
Absolutely, dear friends, yeah.
And who were they?
Catherine Bradley and her niece Edith Cooper. And they were two women who were also devoted to writing, but they felt that as women writers, they would not be taken seriously. So they invented the nom de plume of Michael Field. And their first book was received very well as Michael Field. Nobody knew they were two women. When the news leaked out, they never got the same recognition in their subsequent works once it was known they were two women.
Oh, that's terrible. That's terrible.
Yeah. They wrote poetry and plays. And Ricketts published three or four of their works.
With the Vale Press.
With the Vale Press, yeah. Most of the authors he published were dead. They were the classics.
So he didn't have to pay any royalties.
No.
Yeah.
Some of the illustrations in the Vale Press were done by Thomas Sturge Moore, their friend, who was also a wood engraver.
Okay. Now, the Vale Press, the Vale was the name of their house, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, yeah.
And where was that located?
It was in Chelsea. There's still a street called the Vale, but it's no longer the same street. The Vale at the time was an enclave of early 18th century houses, and they lived in number 2, the Vale.
Was Whistler interested in that house?
Whistler had lived there previously.
I thought so.
Whistler had lived there for 4 years, and they took over the lease from Whistler. And when they left to move to Beaufort Street, Haken, Ricketts' partner, took over the lease.
Because it's quite a lovely house, right?
Yeah, it was. It was, I think, a little bit dilapidated, but it was, you know, in a very quiet corner. Now the Vale is a big street, and it's all big terraced houses, but it's not the same at all as it was. The pictures of the Vale show a little enclave, dead-end street with these three or four houses in it.
And, of course, it was filled with their art.
Yeah, with their collection, mostly.
Yeah. So can you tell me a bit about what excited them to collect?
I think they were just, I mean, art, for Ricketts, art was everything. That's what he lived for. So he did it, he painted, he did sculpture, he did book design, he did all kinds of things. And he collected it, and he wrote about it. I mean, it was, art for him was everything. Shannon sort of followed in his footsteps, but Gordon Bottomley, one of their close friends, an author that they designed the covers for.
Yes.
He said, if Ricketts had never met Shannon, he would have been Ricketts. If Shannon had never met Ricketts, he would have had a totally different life. Shannon had been much sort of influenced by Ricketts, and he was the more dominant partner, although he was not the stronger. He was the dominant partner, but not the stronger partner, almost like a contradiction. Shannon had grown up in a parsonage. His father was a vicar. It was a very stable, you know, he had many brothers and sisters. It was a very stable background. Ricketts had been moved from place to place. I suspect strongly, I don't know for sure, but I suspect strongly that the English upper class can sniff out a fake. And I think they sniffed out there was something wrong with Ricketts' mother. Because there's an incident where she stays in London, and Ricketts and his father and his sister are visiting their grandfather on the Isle of Wight. But Ricketts' mother doesn't go with them. She stays in London. So I suspect that the women of the Ricketts family had figured out that there was something wrong with Mrs. Ricketts. I mean, she wasn't a fake. She was an aristocrat. She was a noble.
Yes.
But she wasn't the daughter of the Marquis de Souzy. She was the daughter of a very important judge in the papal court who was noble, although not titled. You know, if you read her baptismal record, her father is Illustrime, Illustrissime. You know, there's a whole series of titles before his name. I mean, he was noble. It was a noble family.
So why the hell would she lie about it then?
Well, I don't think she wanted to be caught. I mean, she was on the run from her husband. Her husband was looking for her. He spent a lot of time trying to find her.
Okay, right. She sounds like a fantastic
woman. Oh, she was a character. She was a character,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
But she
That's where he gets it from.
Yeah, she was on the run for sure.
Yeah.
And Mr. Suisse was, you know, was doing everything to try to find her. And in fact, he did find her. And she had children. I mean, she had four or five children that were living by her first husband.
Okay.
You know, so they were deprived of the mother. And as I said, her youngest child was only a few months old when she disappeared. You know, she'd just had it a few months before. And Mr. Suisse, he was much older than she was, and he was not at all happy about having been abandoned.
Just getting back to the collecting then, what was the plan behind that? What motivated them to collect, and what did they go after? I know they loved Japanese
prints. This was a time when you could go to a junk shop and prowl through the junk shop and you'd find a Rossetti drawing, or you'd find an original Rembrandt or something, okay? Now all of these collections are poured over. But at that time, you could find masterpieces in these collections.
And they did.
And they did.
And they found quite a few for not much money.
Yeah, for peanuts, yeah, sometimes. And they would go to auctions, and they would usually miss, but occasionally they would get things at auctions. And they would go without meals in the early days. They would go without meals in order to buy works of art. They were utterly sincere. There was nothing fake about it. It was utterly their meaning of life. Art was what was important in life, and they were devoted to it in every respect. So it wasn't to show off or to impress people. I remember asking somebody, why would somebody spend $1 million for a Liechtenstein painting when for $1 million you can buy a minor old master, which has stood the test of time, you know?
Yeah.
And if you spend $1 million for a living artist or a recent artist, it can go down. Yeah. Whereas if you buy an Italian artist of the 17th century for $1 million, you're getting a major artist who's not going to go down. Mm-hmm. And I could never understand why would anybody pay $1 million for a Warhol or for a modern artist, which hasn't stood the test of time. And I never got a proper answer until someone said to me they wanted to show it to their friends.
Bragging rights.
Yeah. And they know that's $1 million painting.
It's an ostentatious display of wealth.
Yeah. Whereas in Rikus and Shannon's case, there was nothing of that. I mean, they weren't...
They didn't have wealth. They were not that well off.
Yeah. And so they were buying because they loved it and it meant everything to them. So in Rikus' time, you could find masterpiece. They found a Rossetti in a junk shop, important Rossetti.
Yes, so they hung on to everything they bought.
I think they might have been willing to sell something to get something better.
Yeah.
Okay. They might have been willing to improve their collection, but they were not there to sell. It was not the investment was never a project. They were interested in value. They were not going to pay too much for something. Rikus had never spent too much for a painting.
He had a prodigious knowledge of...
And unbelievable. One of the reasons it took me 13 years to write the book was because Rikus knew about everything. He knew about Japanese prints. He knew about classical pots, Greek pots. He knew about painting. He knew about sculpture. He knew about everything. So I had to do some investigation in every one of those fields in order to get it right. And even then, I was having trouble finishing. And the other person to whom the book is dedicated, an artist called George Warner Allen, he adored Ricketts. And he'd always adored Ricketts. He was a classical painter at a time when classical painters were considered to be, long dead. And so he enabled me to finish the book because he would say, Paul, you can't say that about technical things in painting. This is wrong. You can't say that. And you have to say this a little bit differently. So he was able to go through the book and say, this is what you can say, this is what you can't say. And then it enabled me to finish the book because I was stuck. Because I thought, I don't know enough about the actual technical side of painting to know whether what I'm saying is good sense or whether I'm saying something which is utterly ridiculous.
Yeah.
So he cleaned it up for me. And so the person who started me was Rupert R. Davis, and the person who helped me finish was George Rowan Allen, so they got the two dedications of the book.
Ricketts outlives Shannon by quite a bit. Is that right?
By 3 years.
Okay, maybe I'm thinking that Shannon is just sort of out of the picture because of his accident.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I can't remember now. I think the accident was in 33 or 36. I can't remember at the moment.
Oh, okay. And Ricketts lived until...
39.
Now, there is a connection with the National Gallery of Canada. Can you talk a bit about that?
It was not a happy relationship. Some people later considered it a disastrous relationship because at a time when the Impressionists were selling for nothing, Ricketts was buying classical paintings. Michelangelo and the great artists were no longer available. So he would get portraits by some of the great artists, but subject pictures by the great artists were out of his reach.
He was hired...
To advise the National Gallery of Canada on purchases.
This was during the 30s?
The last years of his life, the 30s. Yeah. It started in the 20s, because I'm a little bit rusty, but I think it was 11 years he was on that job.
Who hired him, was it?
Brown, director. Yeah. He was not going to advise on Impressionists or post-impressionists or anything like that, so he wouldn't touch those. Okay, so he was advising them to buy portraits by some of the greats like Titian, or subject pictures by the second tier of Italian artists. He bought important pictures for the collection, but this was a time when impressionists were selling for nothing, so he could have bought Monets and Manets and Renoirs and all kinds of pictures for almost nothing. He wouldn't buy them.
Because they were too recent and
he didn't like them.
Tested.
He didn't like open air painting. Although when he went to the Metropolitan in New York and he saw a whole wall of Monets, he had to admit they were better than he thought. But he was not going to, when you had a choice between Italian painting and a French impressionist or a post-impressionist, he hated Cézanne. He was never going to buy Cézanne. He said Cézanne was so interested in his work that he used to leave them in the fields when he finished painting.
Well, he kept painting that one damn mountain in 50 or...
Mont-Saint-Victoire.
Yes.
So just after I came home, I was in the Moncton Library and I was looking through some art journals, and there was an article about the National Gallery of Canada, its history of its collecting, you know, and so I read it with great interest in it. And it said, so the disastrous period when Charles Ricketts advised the National Gallery of Canada. And I thought, why was it disastrous? But then I realized, of course, because he could have bought all those Impressionist paintings, but he wouldn't buy them.
And he was the main guy.
Yeah.
There weren't other people directing this. It was...
I think he had to get Brown's permission and the committee, whatever. But, I mean, they usually followed his suggestions. But you couldn't ask Ricketts to do something against his gré, as they say in French, against his instincts or against... He had very good instincts, but they weren't instincts for anything modern.
It wasn't that there would be an outcry in Canada if he had bought Impressionists.
No, but he hated Impressionism.
Right.
And hated Post-Impressionism even more.
Plus, during the 30s, obviously, you know, money is pretty thin, and anything that they bought might be criticized.
Yeah. And, you know, and I'm sure today a lot of people regret that Ricketts didn't buy the Impressionists. I've seen that wall of Impressionists in the Metropolitan.
Boston has a beautiful collection, too.
Yeah, I've seen that, too. And as I say, even Ricketts, when he saw that, he had to admit in his diary that Monet was far better than he had given him credit for being.
We talked about the fact that Ricketts was his own character, was his own personality. I wonder what impact that period had on him, the fact that there was such a lively society that he lived in. The 1890s, there were a lot of ferment.
And he was just at the time in this, the Goncourt brothers, you know, were also devoted to art and had an example.
Ricketts was good friends with... Wilde was really impressed with Ricketts.
Oh, he was, yeah. Because Ricketts was so witty.
Wilde knew witty.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. When he went one time to visit them with a friend, and Shannon answered the door, Ricketts was out, and they spent some time with Shannon. When they left, Wilde said to his friend, that was the wrong one.
Yes.
Shannon was fun. He was nice, but he was much more gentle and quiet. He wasn't the firecracker and sparkly wit that Ricketts was. Ricketts had a way with words that was very, very clever.
What are your favorite Ricketts stories?
I remember some of his jokes. One of the ones that, I mean, it's a bit vulgar, I'm
That's
sorry.
That's fine, good.
He said in one of his letters that I was reading at Sir Rupert Hart Davis's, there was a disquisition on some sort of attribution of a painting of a very learned, you know, and or some discussion of a Greek poet or something like that. And then he said, did you hear that Lord so-and-so had married a woman that was 30 years his junior? I guess he's going to dig his grave with his brick. That's typical of Ricketts. I mean,
yes.
A learned
from high to low.
Yeah, with a vulgar joke, with a vulgar word. But it was such a shock, you know, going from one to the other.
Yes.
I just roared with laughter. I thought it was so funny.
Well, there are quite a number of these. They're close to being belly laughs in your book, really, because of the quotes that you throw
in.
Yeah,
yeah. But I love that side of Ricketts.
Yes.
I love the side that he could be very high-end intellectual, and at the same time he could tell a dirty joke right in the next line. I thought that was wonderful.
It just shows you that he's so very intelligent, but he doesn't take it entirely seriously. He's not Yeah, he's able to go there.
He took his art seriously, but he said that's not all, you know.
But he was also, as you say, very sensitive.
And he was a pure artist. Chardin and Rickus were never properly trained as painters.
They got the training as the wood
engravers. Chardin sort of was self-taught as a painter. And they had technical problems. They used too much linseed oil in their painting, and so their paintings have darkened a lot. And it's inside the paint, so it's not like a cover which you can remove.
They can't clean it
inside the paint itself.
Yeah,
Ricketts, his anatomy is sometimes a bit strange. My painting upstairs, it's Andromeda, and she's in a position. Her body's in a position that nobody could go into. But Ricketts, he was such an original. He was himself, you know. That's what I loved about him. He was himself. He didn't mind being highly intellectual and really serious. And then he didn't mind, you know, telling a dirty joke. I mean, it was just, I love that. That was what I find so fascinating about him. But he also had a wonderful way with words. He could, you know, he was very, very clever with words.
And he did write. He wrote criticism. He wrote the Prado, was it?
Yeah, he wrote a book on the Prado. He wrote a book on Titian.
Yeah.
He wrote Pages on Art, was a collection of his essays. He wrote Recollections of Oscar Wilde, which he wrote and did a beautiful cover for. And he also did a book of his, can't remember the title, Unrecorded Histories, which is a book of his short stories. No, he was very good. He could turn his hand to anything. He was deeply an artist. I mean, he was a real artist in every sense of the word. But he was basically fragile. You know, he had such an unstable youth, his mother dying young. His father died when he was very young, too. His father only outlived his mother by a few years. So he'd lost both his parents. By the time he'd gone to art school, both his parents were dead. And, you know, and he had grown up partly in England, partly in France. You know, they'd been moving around. So he had a very unstable childhood. I suspect, because he had a great grudge against the Ricketts family.
Because of the way they treated his mother?
I suspect. But as I said, I think they suspected she was not right. She wasn't a French aristocrat.
No.
She wasn't the daughter of the Comte de Soucy, as she claimed to be. But she could have been a pauper, you know, but she wasn't. She was actually a noblewoman from Italy, from a distinguished family. Her father was an important person, a friend of the Pope, personal friend of the Pope, and the head of one of the papal courts. I mean, he was, and they were whole generations of papal judges and whatever in that family. So, you know, they were aristocrats. They weren't titled nobility, but they were nobles. So she wasn't a fake in that sense. She wasn't a fake noble, but she was a fake French noble. And I think in the upper crust, they can sniff that out right away. I mean,
but the thing is, they're sniffing out the fact that she's an Italian noble instead of a French
noble.
But
I don't think she revealed she was an Italian noble.
So they thought she was a commoner.
Yeah, they thought she was a fake, I suspect. Although she said, one of the surprises, she's in the census, I think the 61, I can't remember what's that, 71? No, she was... I think it's 71 census. And it says she was born in Rome. Well, I always thought she was born in Paris, you know, so that was a surprise to me. But it actually says she was born in Rome, which is true. That's where she was really born. That's when she's in London, and her husband and her two kids are in the Isle of Wight with the Ricketts family.
And they've frozen her out.
Yeah. I suspect. Why wouldn't she be with her? But, and it would have been the women. I don't think Ricketts' grandfather would have cared two bits about whether she was a fake Italian or a fake French. But I suspect the women. The women are the snobs in the family very often, and I think the women of the family probably said she's not right, there's something wrong about her when she's a fake and whatever.
Yeah.
And since she didn't want to reveal who she really was because she had a husband, she would have been revealed to be bigamous. If Monsieur Suisse had ever turned up on the scene, he would have said, she's my wife, she's married to me, and we've never been divorced, so she is bigamous.
That's scandalous.
That would have been even worse. You know.
Yes.
So she was caught. She couldn't reveal who she really was.
Yeah.
But she was, I suspect she was spotted as a fake.
So, writing this biography...
put me in a hospital.
Because it was so difficult?
Because I invested so much of myself in it. Because it was a passion for me. It wasn't just a subject that I was interested in. It was a passion.
What do you mean?
Well, I was totally immersed in it. You know, I never thought I was Ricketts or identified with Ricketts, but it became a kind of passion.
Obsession to do what?
To write the book.
No, but to do what with the book?
Publish it.
No, but I mean in the book itself, what was your objective?
To understand Ricketts and make him understood.
You had difficulty doing that.
No, I didn't have difficulty that part. I had difficulty with the technical part of painting and you know, things that I had never been trained in and I had to write about, which was very difficult. But my friend George helped me deal with that.
I see.
But then when I finished the book, trying to get it published.
To find a publisher?
Yeah. Ricketts was not a well-known name. And you know, most English people, even those interested in art, would have said, Charles who? The people who knew about Ricketts were people interested in theater design, private presses, people interested in book design, people interested in the 90s and Oscar Wilde. They knew the name of Charles Ricketts. But outside of that small group, not many people knew. I had a good friend who was a publisher. He wasn't the publisher of that sort of book, but...
What's his name?
Peter Day.
Oh, yes.
You knew Peter Day?
I didn't know him. I definitely know the name.
Oh, he was a character, Peter. A real character. Anyway, he had a good friend, Carolyn Donne, who was an agent. Carolyn Donne. She was a very good agent and a good friend of Peter's, and I knew her socially. I had met her many times. And so she took me on as a charity case just to sell my book. So she's the one who got it published by Oxford University Press. Okay, it was she who hawked it around, as it were. I had a sort of breakdown, unfortunately, and I ended up with Crohn's disease. Between the time I finished and the time I got it published, I had many people telling me, oh, you'll never get that book published. Nobody's interested in Charles Ricketts. And a lot of people were very negative about it, you know, and I devoted 13 years of my life to it.
So,
and it became a passion with me. And then it looked as if it was all for naught, you know, and so I ended up getting Crohn's disease and ended up in hospital. But as soon as the book got published, the Crohn's disease disappeared. And I've been in remission for 30 some years. So I got quite sick over it, but I invested too much of myself in it. It wasn't just a project I was doing. It was something that became a passion, you know, something I wanted.
More than a passion, an obsession.
I wanted to explain Ricketts to the world. I wanted to clear up some of the false ideas, you know, especially the sort of glib reference to them as a gay couple. They weren't in any sense, of modern sense, a gay couple. They were a couple. They might have had sexual contact for a while. But I don't think it was ever a very important part of Shannon's relationship with Ricketts anyway. It was probably more important for Ricketts than for Shannon. It never continued in their relationship. It was their devotion to art,
yes,
to collecting, to making.
Well, they probably loved going out and searching for
stuff together.
Was a bond.
Yeah. And so I wanted to correct some of the misconceptions about Ricketts and Shannon, and I wanted to explain. I felt I had to explain Ricketts to the world, in a sense.
Which is, obviously, I mean, when you've got someone who's as complex and accomplished as that.
Oh, it was a challenge.
Yes.
I learned, it was like an education. I learned so much about everything. As I said, what really got me stuck was the technical side of painting. And my friend George, who had loved Ricketts, he'd never met Ricketts, but had loved Ricketts all through the time, and everybody thought Ricketts was nothing, and he was a third-rate artist. And that reminds me of a terrible story, which I will tell you. Cecil Lewis, one of Ricketts' last proteges, he was a war hero. He was a pilot in the First World War. He was very tall and very good-looking, and Ricketts was obviously in love with him.
For a long time, or?
In the last years, yeah.
Okay.
And Ricketts had Ricketts gave him the money to buy a house in Italy. Cecil had gone to Italy and had made a tour of the Lake District in the north and came back saying how wonderful it was and how easy it was for him to work there. And Ricketts said, well, I'll give you the money to buy a house on Lake Lago Maggiore. So Ricketts gave him the money and he bought this house. And that's where Ricketts' ashes were deposited in the end.
In the garden?
In the garden of that villa, which I visited and with great difficulty. That's quite a story, quite a saga, how I got to see that. Anyway, there's a photo of it in the book, which I took. Apparently it's not there anymore. Someone later, owner of the house, removed the monument to Ricketts, I heard. Anyway, so I met Cecil years later, and he was scathing. He said, why are you spending so much of your life on Charles Ricketts, a third-rate artist? I thought, how ungrateful to call Ricketts a third-rate artist.
After he bought you a damn house.
Yes.
Or villa.
Yes.
In Italy.
Yeah, and so he said, I don't really agree with this idea of sniffing all his underwear and counting all his laundry checks and all that. I thought, what an ungrateful man to talk that way. I talked about Ricketts that way. But I know what he was trying to do. He was trying to say, publish the book. You know, don't spend all your life working on Ricketts. Get on with your life and publish your book. But to call Rick as a third-rate artist, I thought that was very shocking. Cecil was still alive when I published the book. I had to be very careful what I said about Cecil. And in fact, later on, a friend of mine bought a nude drawing, and I had illustrated the drawing in my book, and said to be Cecil Lewis, just to be careful. Cecil Lewis, the nude drawing was of Cecil Lewis.
I see.
Okay, said to be, because I didn't know for sure, but a friend of mine later bought the actual drawing, and on the back of the drawing it says clearly, in Ricketts' hand, Cecil Lewis, there's no doubt. But yeah. I didn't see that. I didn't know that at the time. So I covered myself. I said to be Cecil Lewis.
Yes.
Anyway, so I published the book finally, and Cecil was still alive when I published it. He wrote me a nice letter, and he said, I don't agree. I don't agree with everything you said, but I'm very glad you published the book. Blah, blah, blah. So he wrote me a nice letter, but he didn't want to talk about Ricketts' sexual side at all. I mean, he didn't. He was extremely heterosexual, Cecil Lewis. He wasn't, that side didn't interest him.
Yeah.
Although he benefited from it, obviously.
Well, maybe he played the game a little bit to the point where he got a house out of it.
Well, he'd been a little bit cruel to Ricketts, because he and Ricketts went on a holiday together in North Africa.
Oh, right.
And I think that Cecil Lewis sort of got a little bit antsy to be in such close contact to a man who was obviously in love with him. And so he took up with a German widow, a German divorcee or something like that. And he left Ricketts alone for almost all of the trip. But he was running around with these women that he picked up. And so it was a pretty disastrous trip for Ricketts, who had paid for it. I mean, Cecil told me he felt threatened by it. And, and he sort of felt the need to sort of prove his heterosexuality. And anyway, for poor Ricketts, it was a terrible disaster. Because he was alone the whole time.
It sounds like a pretty sad ending for Charles.
Oh, I think the late last years were tragic for him. Yeah. The man he loved the most in life, Shannon, was hostile to him.
Yes.
So he had to look after him, but avoid upsetting him, so avoid seeing him. So he was doing, even selling part of his collection, he was prepared to sell the whole collection to look after Shannon. So he sold part of his collection to raise money to have a nurse, a constant companion for Shannon. Even under the terrible circumstances of Shannon's hostility, he remained faithful to Shannon and looked after him and didn't disown him, which he could have done.
Well, he might have if Lewis had given him the green light, he might have.
Yeah, although I don't think so. I don't
know.
I don't know of any affairs that Ricketts had. I know that Shannon had affairs, and I know that he had affairs with his models. I mean, not just, I don't know how serious the affairs were. They were just flings or whether they were real affairs, but I know he had relations with his models, and I know that he wanted to get married twice.
Yeah.
Once was to Kathleen Bruce, who turned him down, actually, when he proposed to her. She turned him down. She married Scott of the Antarctic. She was looking for a hero to marry.
Wow.
Her diary is amazing. I mean, I read her diaries, and, before she met Scott, she's looking for this hero who's going to father her children and all that. She had this obsession with finding a hero. And poor Shannon wasn't heroic enough. he did a bust of her, but he didn't meet the standards of a hero. And so she initially married Scott of the Antarctic.
That's about as good as it gets.
Yeah, as a hero. And then they had a son who was a famous botanist. Anyway, I was in correspondence with him too. So, but I've never heard anybody claim that Ricketts had any relationships with any of his models or any of his young proteges, because he had young proteges, but as far as I know, they were platonic. They were one-sided affairs.
Well, it sounds like your life has been deeply enriched by this.
Oh, it was, yeah. Here is a sign of it. I mean, if I had never met Ricketts, just like Shannon, if Shannon hadn't met Ricketts, he would have had a totally different life. If I hadn't met Ricketts, I would have had a totally different life.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. So then when I was working on Ricketts, one of Ricketts' friends was Lynn Philpott, who was this wonderful painter. And his niece became a friend of mine. She had some letters from Ricketts, so I was able to meet her and see the letters and all that. And she was very, very mild and quiet. And one day she said to me, Paul, do you think that once you finish the book on Ricketts, you might be interested in writing a book about my uncle? We would love to have a book about my uncle. And I said, Gabby, I'd love to write about your uncle, but because Philpott was very gay. I mean, he was openly gay. And I said, if I write about your uncle, you must give me carte blanche. Okay? You mustn't say you can't say this, you can't say that. Oh, no problem. You have carte blanche. So I said, okay, when I finished with his Ricketts, I will do Philpott. So when I finished Ricketts and it got published, I started working on Philpott. He was also a fascinating character.
How long did that one take?
It only took 5 or 6 years.
Okay, and who's that published by?
It's published by Ashgate Publishing in England. But it took me less time, partly because he wasn't such a, he was a painter and sculptor, bang, that was it. You know,
yes.
He wasn't book designer, theater designer, collector, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so that limited the range. And Gabby spent all her life collecting papers for him. So she had an immense collection of his work and catalogs and all that. So half the work was done for me.
Yeah.
And he was an interesting character, not as fascinating as Rickus, but an interesting man, kind, good-hearted man, a good man. Gabby had a sister called Rosemary, and I didn't know this when I published the book. I only found this afterwards. But Rosemary had the worst taste in men you can imagine, and she married 3 men, all of whom, one of whom was worse than the next. I mean, you know, they were all bounders, as they call them in England. And one of her husbands had lost a lot of money. And Philpott sold his country estate at Barnard's to pay for her niece's husband's debts.
His niece's husband's debts.
He
That's
sold
decent.
His beautiful country home.
Wow.
To pay.
That's love.
Rosemary's debts. Husband's debts. Gambling debts or whatever debt. I don't know what they were. Investing debts. Anyway, he had big debts. So it shows what a good man he was.
Yeah.
And he was a kind, good man. So he was totally, he wasn't fascinating as Ricketts was, but I liked him.
Yeah.
I was really interested.
You didn't
in
like Ricketts?
Oh, I loved Ricketts.
Yeah.
But I liked Philpott. I liked him. He was a good man, kind man, giving.
Yeah.
And he did have affairs with his models, but he never treated anybody badly. he treated everybody generously.
Mm.
Later on, I discovered things that Gabby didn't know, because Gabby controlled what I knew mostly. But as I interviewed people, I'd have found out things that Gabby didn't know. So I put them in the book. She made me take them out after she promised me that she would not interfere. And,
that's infuriating.
Yeah, and I tried to persuade her. I said, Gabby, you know, it's the truth, and we want to give a true picture of your uncle, blah, blah, blah. So she didn't say anything. And then Gabby died, actually, shortly after. And then her executor phoned me and said, Paul, Gabby instructed me to tell you that you were to take these passages out of the book, this, and this. And if you don't take them out, we will refuse your permission to quote Philpott's letters.
Well, she's just protecting
she
him.
She was
though.
Protective of her
she's
uncle.
Protecting.
And she didn't know those things, okay? When I
Yes, yes.
When she gave me assurances.
Well,
she
what things are they?
Well, that he had. I met a man who was married and had daughters, had two daughters, and he told me that Philpott had a regular lover that he went back to in between his passionate affairs that always finished badly.
Yeah.
He had a sort of standby lover.
Right.
And so I thought, God, can I ask him who it was? And I was sort of dithering, what am I going to do? Because after my experience with Cecil Lewis, who shut me right up, and I started asking questions about anything to do with it.
Because he didn't want to,
Because
they may have had something, and he was...
I doubted.
You doubted, okay.
Yeah.
But I mean, he's so defensive.
He was touchy about that side of it.
So maybe something did happen, he just doesn't want to go there. Yeah. Maybe not.
So
who knows?
Had a bad experience with Cecil, so I thought, I said, do you think you could tell me who this regular lover was?
Yeah.
He said, yes, it was me.
Who's this again?
In the book, I have him as 2 different people. I have the regular lover.
Yes.
And I have him as a friend.
What's his name again?
I can't remember his name at the moment.
Oh, okay.
No, I can't remember. I'll tell you if I remember.
No, that's fine. That's fine.
He said, for heaven's sakes, I have a wife. I have daughters.
Yes.
I don't want this to be known.
No.
But I was the regular lover. When Rick, between his big affairs, he'd come back to me.
Isn't that interesting?
I was never good-looking enough to be one of his passions, but
right.
I was good. It was okay to be in between.
Yeah.
But he was married at that time, and so he had other commitments, and then he had his 2 daughters.
So it's odd, isn't it, the duplicitousness?
Well, it was really his daughters he was worried about. He didn't want his daughters to know about that side of his life. So in the book, I had to put him as 2 separate people, as the friend and as the regular lover, who I never identify. Well, Gabby was furious at that.
Even though you didn't identify him?
Yeah, because she said, he spills the beans on my uncle, but he covers his own tracks.
Right.
So he said, she wanted me to reveal his name, but I had promised I would not. So I said, I can't, Gabby.
Yeah.
I mean, I promised him I would not reveal who he was. So I have to, but anyway, she was not happy with that at all. But she didn't make me take that out. But there was another thing that she told.
Are we on the record now or off?
Well, as long as the name is not given, I don't mind if that's...
Yeah, and you didn't give me the name.
Yeah.
But are we okay with everything that you've said?
Yeah,
or
except the one bit I told you not to repeat.
Yeah. Okay.
There were two things I had to take out.
Yeah.
Before the book was published.
Okay.
But she also left money in her will to have more illustrations. She left £10,000.
To put more illustrations into your book.
Yeah.
That's, yeah, okay.
She wanted the book to be as, because she was unmarried.
Yeah.
And her uncle had become her life's work.
Interesting.
Okay, and so she was interested in making the best possible book. For the book, it's got an awful lot of color illustrations, you know, for the price it is, because of Gabby's £10,000 bequest for more illustrations.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
What's the name of that book again?
Glyn Philpott.
That's just his name?
Yeah.
That's it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, final question. From what you've been telling me, what's the best advice you can give to someone who is thinking about writing a biography of someone?
Well,
don't get obsessed.
That's good advice. It was my mistake to get so to become so committed to it and to be so involved in it, so that when it was in danger of not being published, I got really sick.
Yeah.
I ended up in hospital.
Yeah.
With it, and they said, if we don't settle you down, we're going to remove a third of your colon.
It's 13 years of your life. No wonder you're so upset.
Yeah. But I had one friend who was very negative about it. And I kept telling him, you'll never get that published.
You'll never get that published. Yeah, yeah.
No one's interested in Charles Ricketts. Who's ever heard about Charles Ricketts?
Yeah.
No one's going to publish that book and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that really devastated me at the time. It's at a time I was very vulnerable.
Yeah.
And having him harp on and on and on about how no one would ever want to publish Charles Ricketts, it was really devastating. But anyway, I mean, it ended up very happily with the Oxford University Press. It helped me get the job in Moncton, actually, because I
did
mean,
it.
Yeah,
okay.
Because when I came to Moncton, I applied for the job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had just published a biography which was published by Oxford University Press. You can't get better than
that's
that.
Yes.
So I got the job at the university right away.
So what about the advice? I just barged in there.
Well, I think that the prep is everything. And Rupert Hart Davis told me two things, because he'd written biographies. He'd written a biography of Hugh Walpole. So he said, Paul, you have to do two things. First of all, you have to create a chronology of his life. Okay? So you start from, you know, all the letters, all the information you get, you know, so you know what he was doing in January 1892.
So very fine-tuned.
Yeah, so you create this biography, this chronology of all his life from the beginning to the end, and every date of every letter, every, you know, everything he publishes, everything that you put it in there. So it will keep you from going wrong, because even though you don't follow chronology absolutely, I mean, a biography is chronological in basic, but there are certain areas where you go with a whole section, and then you go backwards and deal with the difference, like, especially someone like Ricketts, who was a book designer, theater designer, you couldn't mix them all together. So you did theater designer, book designer, blah, blah, in separate sectors. But you had to cover a number of years in each one. So he said, doing a chronology will keep you from making serious errors. And the second thing is, you must have a really good outline of your book. Before you start writing, have a really good outline.
So what does that mean?
Every chapter broken down by subject, by theme, by, you know, by matter that's going to be dealt with, you know, by incidents that are going to be dealt with. So have a very, really detailed outline, and then the book writes itself. So I followed his advice. Oxford accepted the book, but they made me cut it by a third. It's already 400 pages, but it was originally 600.
That must have been painful.
It made it better.
Okay.
It was more concise. It removed repetition. I also had a wonderful friend, Paul Chipchase, who was an editor at Cambridge University Press. He went through it and cleaned it up. It needed cleaning up, because I'm not very good at detail. You know, I'm good at the big picture and drawing the lines.
You are good at detail. There's some great detail in there.
Yeah, but he helped clean up a lot of mess in my details.
Okay.
I mean, that was his job. He was a professional editor at the Cambridge University Press, but he spent weeks cleaning up my manuscript. And so I owe him a lot. And so that's the two things you have to do. Do a chronology and do a really detailed outline, before you start writing. That was Rupert Hart Davis who told me this, and who himself was, you know, a great publisher, editor, edited Oscar Wilde's letters, published a biography of Hugh Walpole, you know, edited many books.
Great letter writer, too.
Yes, and he was executor for many, many writers, you know, Hugh Walpole and many others.
Okay.
And it's funny thing was when, because Hugh Walpole at that time, you know, in the 80s, 70s and 80s, you know, was one would have thought was pretty much forgotten about. But Rupert said, not at all. He said, that's what we live on. We live on the royalties from his books. That's one of our main sources of income. Mm-hmm. In his retirement was the executor for the Ewell Paul estate. He was also entitled to receive the royalties. So that's what he was living on. Rupert was a really nice man. He, you know, he helped me a lot. And in fact, when he had a small costume design by Ricketts, and when he died, he left it to me in his will.
Again, another kindness.
Eh? Yeah. But I had six or seven Ricketts costume designs, not the finished, beautiful finished ones, but working designs.
Yeah.
And when I gave a bunch of drawings to the Bieber book, I gave that along with the one that Rupert gave me to the Bieber book.
Well, thanks for your kindness in talking to me this evening.
You're letting me indulge myself in a subject that I love. It's fun for me, too.
Well, and it's lovely to hear about such a wonderful character. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
I've been speaking to Paul Delaney, who is a retired professor of English.
Yeah.
And currently working on...
Acadian history. How genealogy elucidates history.
Very good. Thanks again.
Welcome. Pleasure.
Okay.
Well, that was fun. It wasn't as painful as I thought it might be.
No, it was great.